Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the leading vitreo retinal specialists of today. Today's episode, running on Super Bowl Monday, after arguably the greatest comeback in a sports championship game ever by the New England Patriots, features massive Patriots homer and pediatric ophthalmologist Dr. Matthew Weed. Dr. Weed sees patients in Spokane, Washington now after completing residency and fellowships in pediatric ophthalmology and ophthalmic genetics at the University of Iowa. He joined me last week over the phone to discuss approaching patients with hereditary retinal disease, his interest in ophthalmic genetics, and a fairly accurate prediction of yesterday's Super Bowl result. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. We have nearly 3,000 subscribers now, and the website has become a tremendous educational resource. Check out the archived episodes. There really is something for everyone, although one of my fellows, Dr. Stephen Ryder, finds that comment funny. It is true. If you are a medical student or resident, check out our residency and fellowship match panel episodes. We will be doing more physician finance with Dr. Chirag Shah upcoming. And if that sounds interesting to you, check out our interview with Jim Dolly, the White Coat Investor. Check out his podcast as well. He's got a great podcast now up on his website, whitecoatinvestor.com. Plus, we have all the great ideas and thoughts we've gotten from the very generous doctors who have joined us on the show. You can also like the Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes store. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Matthew Weed. Dr. Weed is a pediatric ophthalmologist and an inherited eye disease specialist at the Spokane Eye Clinic in Spokane, Washington. He previously was a resident and then fellow at the University of Iowa. Matt, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Jay. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. You know, we just did the residency match panel went up last week, and this is a relevant thing to bring up because we have never actually worked together or even been in the same place for longer than a couple hours.
That's true.
We met on the interview trail.
Yep.
And we met at Michigan, if I'm not mistaken. I think that's right,
and I remember we kind of kept in touch after that, and you helped me figure out, you know, what I should wear to the dinner at UCLA.
Grateful
for that.
Because,
very helpful.
You were the second day, and then you were staying on the wrong side of the sticks when you came to Miami, and you asked me where the hotel was, and I was like, don't stay there.
That's right. I had forgotten about that. Yes, I think I probably owe you my life, actually.
That's okay. That's why you're doing this. This is all. It's all payback, so...
Oh, good. We're good.
We're square. So anyway, I brought that up just because if there are resident, you know, people, residents, fellow, I mean, it's interesting. You meet people a couple times and you stay in touch. We've stayed in touch over the years. And, you know, you grew up in Utah, and one of your childhood friend, I'm not going to put those words in your mouth. I'm sure you guys were friendly. But one of your childhood acquaintances was Jack Stringham, who's one of my current fellows. And something I didn't realize for a long time just tells you how small the world is. So at the risk of embarrassing Jack Stringham, who's the nicest guy in the world and a really good fellow, let's talk about growing up with Jack Stringham, the Jack Stringham, and growing up in Utah. How did you end up going from there to being an ophthalmologist?
Sure. So Jack and I did grow up together. That's right. He and I met when we were in grade school. He moved into the same neighborhood that I lived in, and I think he's a year or two younger than I am. We've been on... I don't even know how many camping trips together. We played a lot of ball together. I used to be able to beat him pretty reliably, and then there was one year when he grew like 6 inches, and all of a sudden I couldn't dominate him as I used to be able to.
Can he dunk?
I don't know if he can.
You could. I remember we talked about this, but...
Yeah, I one of the greatest moments of my life was when I was 18 and finally put one down, and I actually got one down like a year ago, so I've still got a little bit left in the legs. And I'll bet he could. He was tall and could jump quite a bit, so I'll bet he could.
So you went to Utah, then you went to Brigham Young.
That's right. Yep.
Where in addition to you know doing your studies that were prepared for medical school, you were also editor of the newspaper, correct?
Let's see, not at BYU, as far as I can remember. I did that in high school for a bit had a good time. But yeah, that was more of a high school thing.
Then you then traveled after college, correct? You were abroad, and then you ended up at UCSD for your medical school. Why ophthalmology? What happened along the way? Or were you thinking that before you went to medical school?
Yeah, so I originally was going to be a hand surgeon. That was my plan for the first several years of medical school. I liked the anatomy of the hand. I thought it was super cool. I liked the intricate nature of the surgery. I liked being able to sit down while I operated. Some of these things might sound familiar to an ophthalmologist. And then late third year of school, I was doing my first ortho rotation and really just kind of realized that the only thing I liked in ortho was hand, and I didn't really like anything else. The spine cases were just deadly. And I liked the other people that I worked with, and I loved their work ethic. I respected them quite a bit, but I just didn't see myself doing ortho. And so I started kind of looking around, and my dad actually was a patient of Alan Crandall at the Moran Eye Center in Salt Lake and said, hey, if you know your son ever wanted to come up and rotate with us, we'd love to have him. And I actually read a textbook on ophthalmology and sight unseen decided, hey, that sounds great. I'm going to be an ophthalmologist. I hadn't ever been in a clinic or anything like that. Just kind of decided that's what I wanted to do and made it happen. And I haven't looked back. It's been great. I've been very happy with my decision. And I've actually met several ophthalmologists, including people like Don Kikawa at UCSD, who's an oculoplastics guy there, who are reformed or former hand surgeon wannabes like myself. So maybe there's some sort of connection there.
Well, I guess they're both pretty intricate, anatomy-dependent, and extremely important functionally for patients, right? You know, I think ophthalmology attracts a lot of us because of the quality of life difference we can make sometimes and how important vision is, but your hands are pretty important too.
Yep.
You know, especially
I agree.
You know, your dominant hand is we take it for granted. I think just like a lot of times we take our vision for granted until things aren't going so well.
I think it's the same thing. It's microsurgery. It's something that is a very important way that we interact with others. It's detailed anatomy, and I think that's a good connection.
You went to Iowa, and you ended up doing a couple of different fellowships there. Tell us about that.
Well, I went out and I interviewed at Iowa, and I realized that I just really felt like I fit in there. And so my wife, Mallory, and I moved there without knowing anybody in Iowa City. We had a great time there. I was there for first 3 years of residency, during which, incidentally, we recruited the one, the only, Jack Stringham. And we thought we had the inside track, but he decided to take his talents to South Beach instead. So
I think Ryan Isom played a role there. He Ryan's a good guy. You talked to him as well.
Yeah.
When Jack was interviewing, he was either chief or about to be chief, and
I think that's right.
So, and then
but yeah, so I was there for residency. Yep. And then when I was, I think I was a first or second year student, I had already decided that I wanted to do peds. I had had some exposure to that prior to residency and really enjoyed that. I loved helping kids with strabismus. I feel bad. There's an unfortunate social stigma against a lot of people that have strabismus that doesn't hold water like we know, but it's something I like helping people with. I love talking to parents. A lot of people are, I think, a little bit repelled by peds for that reason, but I really like it. I like talking down anxious parents like I would be if I was in their situation. I like reassuring them when, you know, we can do that appropriately. And I also like being there with them when things aren't okay and things need to change and we need to intervene. I like being there with them in the trenches, so to speak. But during the second year of residency, I was really enjoying working in Dr. Ed Stone's retina clinic. He has a once-a-week clinic at Iowa where he sees only patients with inherited eye diseases. And at the end of each clinic, he has what's called stone rounds, which is sort of a come one, come all, free pizza, Socratic method teaching, where he'll put up cases and that he saw that day. And these are just incredible ophthalmic genetics cases that I think a lot of us would only see, you know, maybe once in residency or once in a career, and for him they're just something that he sees on a weekly basis. And I was really attracted to that because of his enthusiasm, because he was a world expert, and because I think, and he thinks too, that the world of ophthalmic genetics is our next big thing in ophthalmology, sort of similar to how patients with wet AMD. There was a frame shift with the anti-VEGF drugs that came on the market over the past several years, albeit affecting less patients with these genetic conditions, but I think that that's the next big front. I think it's the final frontier in ophthalmology. Dr. Stone asked if I wanted to stay on another year after residency to be a fellow with him and with Dr. Arlene Drack, also at Iowa, and I jumped at the chance. I saw patients each week in their clinics, dozens of patients that have these retinal dystrophies, and then I also did basic science and clinical research on the same conditions at the Wynn Institute for Vision Research, which is an adjunct at the University of Iowa. I had a great time. I really enjoyed doing it, and I dedicate part of my practice now to seeing pediatric patients with inherited eye diseases.
Let's talk a little bit about inherited eye diseases. You would never claim to be Ed Stone, but you got to learn from him for over a year, even before your fellowship and then during your fellowship. A lot of retina specialists listen to this podcast, and not many of us have a background in either pediatrics or inherited retinal degenerations beyond the exposure we got in maybe our pediatrics rotation during residency. And as we get further and further away from that time, sometimes it gets hard to remember just some general principles and how to approach these situations. So you're a retina specialist out in practice, and you don't have access to Matt Weed or Ed Stone. What's the approach for a possible hereditary maculopathy or peripheral retinopathy in a pediatric or adult patient? Like, what do you typically, what sort of history are you asking? What's really important, and what are you thinking about on your very, very vast differential?
Sure. I've got a couple of things that I think have been helpful to me. I think the first point that I would suggest is that we need to be suspicious. Anytime you see something that is bilateral, symmetric, and in the retina, it definitely has to be on your differential that this could be one of those inherited retinal dystrophies, particularly if it has features that look like a known dystrophy, like you see pisiform flex in Stargardt disease, or a vitelliform lesion centered on fixation in Best disease. If the patient has any systemic or syndromic features, then you kind of have to have your antennae raised a little bit. Certainly if there's any known family history of a patient with a retinal disease at a young age, that has a high index of suspicion as well. And then the other thing I would say on that is I've seen dozens and dozens of patients that were diagnosed with AMD at a young age, and I don't think that 40-year-olds get AMD. They might get the MD part, but the A, not so much. So if you're seeing a 40-year-old and it kind of looks like AMD, but obviously they don't really meet the age criteria, there are other things to think about. And things that I think about in that scenario would be things like pattern dystrophy, presumed ocular histoplasmosis syndrome, JXT, myopic degeneration, Best disease, old CSR, or even new CSR. If it's really bad wet AMD, like it looks like just the world's worst wet AMD, especially if there's a family history, you have to think about Soresby fundus dystrophy. So just kind of other things. Have your antennae up. Be suspicious if you see something that's bilateral and symmetric and it maybe looks like AMD, but they're a little too young for that. The second thing I would say is it's important to be systematic. Like you mentioned, Jay, a lot of these conditions are things that many of us, if not almost all of us, don't see very commonly at all. And because they're also potentially of a very high impact on the patient's vision and quality of life, they can definitely provoke sort of a sphincter puckering response on the part of the clinician. And I think because of that, it's important to have a systematic approach. I learned from Dr. Stone to, on intake for an initial evaluation for any patient that I suspect has an inherited eye disease, I ask the same set of 8 questions. And I could broaden it from there, but there are these 8 questions that I always go through. The first one I ask is, what was the age of onset? Because that really can narrow down the differential quite a bit. If it's something that was congenital, then I'm thinking somewhere along the line of labor congenital amaurosis spectrum versus something in the later first decade of life or teenage years, then you think more about something like Stargardt disease or retinitis pigmentosa. The second question I ask is about their earliest symptoms, and I really try to pin the patients down here. and not accept an answer like, oh, my vision just wasn't normal. I really am trying to get at whether it was a visual acuity problem, whether it was a peripheral vision problem, whether there was nyctalopia or photophobia or decreased color vision. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of the categories that I'm looking to place their earliest symptoms into. And I found that patients, when you're inquiring about photophobia or nyctalopia, you could ask a person that like doesn't have a rod photoreceptor within a country mile of their retina if they're night blind, and they'll say, oh no, I'm fine, because they just don't know anything different. They've been they've been nyctalopic their entire life. And so if you say, are you night blind, they'll just look at you like, well, no, you know, because they just don't know what that means. And so the way to get at that would be to say something like, if you had to pick between a room that most people would think was too, a little too bright or a little too dim, which would you pick? And then they'll come out with it. Mm-hmm. They'll say, oh yeah, I prefer it to be a little too bright. You can ask them if they see stars at night or if they've ever been lost on a camping trip. I've had one patient who said that he wasn't night blind when he was asked in that fashion, but then he revealed that when he was on a trip at the lake, he walked off the end of a pier in the middle of the night because he didn't see the edge of it. So those are just kind of some other ways to get at that question. After the earliest symptoms question, I ask what the previous diagnoses have been, because a lot of these patients have seen other providers in the past and they've been given another diagnosis. And that can be helpful for a couple of reasons. Number one, these things can evolve, and so it's good to know what the guy looking at it 20 years ago thought it was, or what the physician looking at it 5 years ago thought it was, because that can kind of give you an idea. And the other reason, and perhaps even more importantly, is that the first diagnosis that's made for a patient, especially with something this significant, Dr. Stone always liked to say that it's written on the blackboard in paint. Mm. And so whatever that doctor years ago said it was is what the patient is going to be clinging to. And you might disagree with that diagnosis or even just have a different term for that diagnosis, but if you say to a patient who thinks that they were told that they had cone dystrophy, that they have Stargardt disease or achromatopsia, which isn't that dissimilar. They're both cone-related problems, and cone dystrophy would be a good term for them. But if you use a different term, be prepared for the patient to secretly think that you might be an idiot, because they know, I don't have cone dystrophy, or I don't have Stargardt disease or achromatopsia. I've got cone dystrophy, and this doctor doesn't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So I always like to know what patients have been told in the past. I ask about syndromic features, specifically for things like Usher syndrome. I ask about hearing loss, cochlear implants, hearing aids, delayed walking, which is present in type 1 Usher system due to vestibular dysfunction. And then for things like Bardet-Biedl syndrome, I ask about extra digits, developmental delay, obesity. I also take a look at the patient's general body habitus to see if I can see any syndromic features or anything that looks suspicious. A lot of times BBS or Bardet-Biedl syndrome patients will have a little scar on the ulnar side of their hands, and they won't even know why, because their parents never told them that they had a little extra digit there that was clipped off. And then I ask about chronic medications to make sure we're not dealing with like an occult Plaquenil retinopathy or something like that that you just can't miss. I do a complete family history, and I diagram it on a pedigree, which is drawn out formally. I ask about driving history, and driving is something that, as ophthalmologists, we know isn't probably our favorite topic to discuss with patients. It's a sensitive thing, and I found a good neutral way to ask about that is just to say, how has this affected your driving? Because that way patients can say, oh, are you crazy? I haven't driven for years. Or perhaps if it's a patient that you know shouldn't be driving, then they say, oh, it's, you know, it hasn't affected at all, it's fine. And then you kind of know how you need to approach that conversation. But I think that's a good neutral way to bring it up. And then I also perform a refraction for all patients. I think characteristically, and speaking in generalizations, patients with a really high plus refraction, I think more about something along the LCA spectrum, whereas with a really high minus refraction, it's typically more retinitis pigmentosa related. And so that's a good way to distinguish between those two conditions, which are often more overlapped than you might guess. And then finally, if there's a lot of minus with a bunch of cylinder at an oblique axis, in my experience, that goes along with congenital stationary night blindness type conditions.
Hmm. Those are good, very good pearls. How, you know, this is a very, there's always exceptions to the rule. How symmetric do things have to be for you to say, you know, you said that it's better to have a higher degree of suspicion because we usually don't think about these things. But let's have the opposite scenario. Someone comes in labeled with something but without a family history, but things aren't really that symmetric. common, uncommon with these hereditary, or maybe it's a sporadic mutation, kind of genetic maculopathies?
Yep. I think that would be pretty uncommon. In my experience, having seen now hundreds of different patients with genetically confirmed retinal dystrophies, these are type of things where it's almost like symmetry, right? You could take the image in Photoshop and flip it 180 about the vertical, and you would see the same thing. And so these are almost categorically very, very symmetrical things where you can see the exact same process happening in both eyes. And I think if you don't, you need to be thinking, okay, is this more of an inflammatory condition? Is this a white dot syndrome or something like that? I guess a couple of exceptions would be if you see unilateral RP. Some of the things I think about would be, is this a female patient that's a manifesting carrier? Mm. But aside from that, unilateral RP, the things I'm thinking about are things like Azor, Duzen from a nematode, an old trauma, an old RD, chronic uveitis, an occult iron,
syphilis in Miami.
Foreign body syphilis, yep. Those are all things to think about if you're seeing someone with unilateral RP. If things are very asymmetric, in my opinion, chances are it's more of an inflammatory thing or a prior trauma and less likely to be a genetic retinal dystrophy.
Well, in addition to your interest in genetics, you're also practicing, you know, pediatric ophthalmologist. You do strabismus surgery. And one of the things we talked about before coming on air, which is always an interesting topic, is the biggest intersection between retinal surgeons and strabismus surgeons is diplopia after scleral buckles.
Yes.
And it's thankfully not something that happens most of the time. It happens a certain percentage of the time. And, you know, it's kind of one of the things that we accept along with the buckle. In certain scenarios, the buckle is important to keep the retina attached, whether it's through a straight buckle or a buckle vitrectomy. But mm-hmm. Diplopia can happen. You've scrubbed in both types of surgeries, both the original retina surgery when you were a resident and now sometimes doing surgery on patients who have had a previous buckle. And then doing surgery for diplopia. Anything that you've sort of gleaned from the experience being both sides of the fence, any sort of conclusions you come to? And I bring this up knowing that you may not have anything because there isn't a strong consensus in the retina community the best way to isolate a muscle for a scleral buckle. Or, you know, we understand basic principles like don't split the muscle, make sure the bands go under the muscles. But otherwise, anything that you've noticed or picked up, certain types of diplopias which are more common?
You know, I think those are good questions. I, having seen buckles placed primarily and then also having done surgery on patients that have had a buckle in the past and now have strabismus, like you said, a couple of things that I've noticed are, number one, these are patients that I always counsel in terms of preoperative strabismus surgery planning, that the rate of success is going to be lower, and so they need to know that in advance. Number two, I think that during the buckle placement, like you mentioned, the basic things like not splitting a muscle and making sure that the buckle is properly positioned is good. I think there are two schools of thought in terms of how much muscle to dissect and how much muscle to expose and whether to really clean far back on the muscles or just do enough to slip the encircling element underneath. In terms of strabismus surgery, I've seen excellent surgeons get great results from both of those techniques. For example, for a muscle recession, I've seen some of my mentors do just minimal dissection sharply, just right over the insertion of the muscle and really not clean off tenons or intermuscular septi too much at all and have great outcomes. You know, one advantage to that is if the muscle were to slip or come loose, it doesn't really go very far because it's got other things holding it there. But I've also seen other mentors that have had great outcomes for years doing much more dissection, either bluntly or sharply. So I think either way that the vitreoretinal surgeon chooses to go about it, the important thing is to just be very careful with the muscles, treat them with respect, and then also the conjunctival closure. I think that's just as important as the muscle element, because from a strabismus surgeon standpoint, the hard part for me in terms of fixing strabismus is often much less to do with locating the muscle and isolating the muscle and getting a hook under the muscle and more with just the exposure. If the conjunctiva mm-hmm. is very stuck down, then that can just make the case very difficult from the get-go. And so treating the conj with as much respect as possible, I think, is a good good philosophy. One of my glaucoma mentors, Dr. Lee Allward at the University of Iowa, used to tell me, conjunctiva is your only friend in the world. And so that's definitely true for a glaucoma surgeon, but I think it can also be appropriate for a strabismus surgeon or for a retina surgeon.
You do have your own website, mattweedmd.com. And for anyone listening to this, I took a look. You use Squarespace just like I do. It's a nicely set up and gives a lot of information for your patients. What motivated you to start your own website? You started it, I think, while you were still a fellow. And it's not purely, you know, you have your own website through your practice. So this isn't necessarily just for your work. You use it kind of as a venue. What was kind of the impetus for you to do that?
While at the University of Iowa, one of my co-residents is iSteve. His name's Steve Christensen, and he was a couple of years after me in training. And he has lectured at Academy and things like that at a bunch of different national meetings on the use of online media for ophthalmologists. And he and I got to be good friends, and he said, "Hey, Matt, you know, I think this might be something that you'd be interested in and you might enjoy it." And so as a fellow, I started to do some kind of social media type stuff on a professional Facebook page and Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff. And then, like you mentioned, I started a website once I was finished up with fellowship. And the driving force behind it was just another way to communicate with my patients. It was a way to tell them about me and about my clinic and about what to expect. There's sections on there that have frequently asked questions. And also, like you mentioned, it's a way to kind of talk to other people, friends, family, and the like about ophthalmology, topics that I find interesting. I've got stuff on there about celebrities with prominent eye conditions and kind of just describing the amazing things that people can do despite severe visual impairments. I really enjoy doing it. It's a creative outlet for me, and I think it's also a good practice builder. I've had a number of patients, even just being in practice for about 6 months, who've said, you know, we were looking around town for an ophthalmologist, and we happened upon your website, and you seemed nice, and so here we are. And so it's been a good thing on that front, too.
iSteve is an interesting resource. I had heard about it but never gone to it. I'd have to check it out. You should consider a podcast. Podcasting is a great venue too. And maybe we, you know, this could be a jump start for you to go that route. Now we're going to go to finish up. We're going to go to the obligatory sports conversation because that's something that comes up a lot in the 8 years that I've known you.
I have a very important question for you, Jay.
Go.
Very important question. Has there ever been anything more predictable in your entire life than Dwayne Wade and Rajon Rondo failing to coexist peacefully in Chicago? I mean, as soon as the ink was dry, I said that's not going to work. You know, these two guys have hated each other for years.
The listeners probably know I'm a big Miami sports fan. They may not know you're a Boston sports fan. You are a Celtics. You're a Celtics fan, Patriots fan. So you know Rondo really well. I know Wade very well. You know, the part about it that surprises me is, and again, I just maybe didn't know enough about Chicago Bulls basketball before, but I'm surprised that Jimmy Butler has been as diva-ish slash involved in this controversy as he has been. I just didn't know enough about him before this started, but you're right. This was ultimately very predictable.
It's been very predictable.
Almost as predictable as the Pats making the Super Bowl this year.
That's right.
You know, so we're going to be dated because this episode is probably not going to come out before the Super Bowl, which is this weekend.
Okay.
So people are going to know the result. So we're going to come out.
We can get it on the record.
We're not going to make any predictions because I don't want to put you on the spot. Unless you want to put yourself on the spot. We're going to talk about legacies for a second, though, because, you know, the Pat-Steelers game was, I think, the first time in my life I was watching, or in his, because I was born before Tom Brady started his career, but in Tom Brady's career, I wasn't rooting for them. I was rooting for the Steelers because I don't like the Patriots. But
yes, a common sentiment, by the way.
Very common. But I respected him, and I watched that game, and at the end of the game, I'm like, I'm watching the greatest quarterback I have ever seen. I wasn't around for some of the guys people talk about. I don't know who the greatest quarterback of all time is, because I can't compare to people I've ever seen. I'm like, this is the greatest quarterback I've ever seen. I was always Manning and Manning-Brady arguments, but I was just like, this guy is just unbelievable, right? So I'm going to cite this article again. Will be dated in a week when this goes up, but you know, John Clayton on ESPN wrote an article today, and he ranked the top, you know, 10 quarterbacks of all time.
Okay.
And I'm going to read them to you in order. He has
from 10 to 1.
From 10 to 1.
Okay.
Aaron Rodgers, Terry Bradshaw,
Bear.
Dan Marino, Brett Favre, Elway, Otto Graham, who I don't know enough about, but
no idea who that is.
Johnny Unitas.
Okay.
Peyton, Montana,
yep.
And then Brady.
Yep. I agree. That's a fair list.
That's a fair list.
Kudos to you, John Clayton.
I think Marino should be higher, but
spoken like a true Dolphins fan.
I think Rodgers should be lower at this point. But at what point, as a Patriots fan watching him, did you reach the conclusion I did that he was the greatest quarterback of all time? Take off your Homer hat for a second. Like,
yeah.
Obviously, you've always loved him, but like, at what point were you like, oh, like this guy is definitely the greatest I've ever seen?
Super Bowl 2 years ago in Seattle, coming back from a big deficit in the second half against a tenacious defense in a stadium, I think, where there was a predominance of Seahawks fans, not 2 weeks removed from the start of the unfortunate Deflategate character assassination on behalf of Roger Goodell.
You're like the ophthalmology version of Bill Simmons, by the way. I just
want to throw that out there. That's right. That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. But that was when I realized that I was watching the GOAT, the greatest of all time. And then, like you said, last week against Pittsburgh, I mean, that was just surgical is what it was. That was the word that kept coming to my mind. It was surgical. It was unclear to me if Mike Tomlin was actually conscious on the sideline or if someone needed to get him some smelling salts or something, because Pittsburgh, for them just sit back in soft zone. Brady looked like he was playing catch with his son in the backyard or something. I mean, it was just easy pitch and catch all game long. I don't think Atlanta will let him off that easy this weekend against the Falcons in the Super Bowl. With that being said, I like the Pats this weekend. So we'll see.
It's funny. Like, you hit this certain point. If for years, you know, you watch Brady, and you don't know this feeling because you didn't root against him, but I mean, you'd watch him, and you'd be like, throw an interception here. Like, back in your mind, like, he's going to throw a pick, or someone hit him and, like, cause a fumble, or, like, you just got to hit this guy. You never could realistically be rooting for him to miss a throw, and I didn't realize that until recently, this year. You know, I'll watch other games, and you'll see quarterbacks miss. You know, the difference between a great quarterback and a good quarterback is those couple of throws that they, you know, miss a guy going down the sideline, you know, for a 40-yard out. Like, they'll just miss it. They'll miss it by a couple yards, and you'll forget about it, and the game will go on. Brady never misses those throws. You can't.
He's had a nice year from a deep pass standpoint, especially.
Right.
I think for the past few years he had a tough time with the deep ball, but this year it's been a lot better. I think it was a point of emphasis for him in the
But even the short throws, he doesn't throw behind people, you know, he doesn't throw high, you know, and I just realized, I was like, you can't actually root for him. Like, I just realized I never actually rooted for him to make a mistake, because I think unconsciously I was like, he's not going to, right? Whereas other quarterbacks you could. And you're not, I don't know if you're a tennis fan, but I was watching, you know, Federer and Nadal yesterday, right? And,
right.
I rooted against Roger Federer for years, not because I don't like him, because I like Nadal better. But I was watching that match, and I was just like, at some point I realized, I'm just rooting for Federer to make mistakes. It's like, not that Nadal is playing badly, it's just that this guy is playing so well that when he's playing well, there's really nothing you can do. And it's the same thing with Brady, in the sense that you can... You stop rooting for him to make mistakes. You just start rooting for someone else on his team to let him down. You're rooting for the receiver to drop a ball. You're rooting for the offensive line to let him get hammered. But it's incredible, you know, because I've gone full 180 on this. I think he's been my least favorite player in the NFL, and even up until this year. I don't know why. Maybe I'm just maturing. Maybe I'm just like a more mature, serene, zen sports fan than I used to be, but...
I think it's just a respect for people that have achieved the highest level of their sport, right? It's the same thing with Federer and Brady, and it's where people who are, if they're on their game, like, it's just over. You know, you see it in baseball too with a pitcher who
Rivera is a great example.
Who has good stuff, where it's just like, well, this isn't going to work if you're cheering for the other team because they're just unstoppable. And incidentally, that's why I think that Aaron Rodgers belongs on that list, even if it is low on number 10 because of some of the throws that he can make. And when he's on, there's just no getting around it. He's going to get the job done.
So last question before we go, because I know we're going to bore people with our sports talk, but how, you know, maybe we're going to tie this into surgery, and you know, we both operated today. We all do surgery. We want the best possible outcomes for our patients. We want our patients to do well. Yep. A lot of our analysis in society, medicine, sports, whatever, is results driven, right? We make conclusions based on what happened, but like when you actually sit and analyze things, maybe you wouldn't have done things differently, you know, but maybe things just happened to work out a certain way. And I'm going to tie this into Brady. Is you said you realized he was the greatest of all time in that Super Bowl, which they won.
Mm-hmm.
But the Seahawks came a yard away from winning that game.
Yes, they should not have won that game. You're right.
Right. So if the Seahawks score a touchdown there by giving it to Marshawn Lynch, which is what everyone thought they would do, does that devalue? I mean, Brady would still be the greatest. I mean, it shouldn't change our perception of it, but as a, we would be looking at him being like, you know, Tom Brady's 3-3 in Super Bowls, and he hasn't won one in, you know, 15 years, and, you know, I don't. That would be the narrative right now heading into the Super Bowl. And it's so funny because, like, again, results are important, but especially in a team sport or in our standpoint in surgery or medicine where, you know, the physician has only so much control, and football, the quarterback only has so much control over what happens around them. It's a little unfair, right? It's like, you know, what if Brady, you know, had never won another Super Bowl? Is he not the greatest of all time? I still think he would be, but I wouldn't, maybe wouldn't perceive him the same way.
A couple things on that. I think number one, just what you mentioned is why Dan Marino is not higher on that list, right? Because he, for whatever reason, wasn't in the circumstances that Peyton was in, or that Montana was in, or that Brady was in to have the chance to win that many rings. And so that's why he's not higher on that list, even though his quarterback stats are rival those of anybody. And the second thing I would say is that I once saw a patient at the VA clinic in residency who had a MAC-OFF retinal detachment, and it had been repaired, and I was seeing him a couple years after the fact, and his vision was 20/20, and I said, oh man, that's amazing. And I thought to myself, I wonder who did his surgery. And I looked in the records, and sure enough, it was who I thought it was. And I sent this surgeon an email saying, hey, I just wanted to let you know this guy looks great, you know, MAC-OFF, and he's 20/20 now, years later, incredible job. And surgeon wrote back to me and said something along the lines of, you know, this was no different than any other patient with a MAC-OFF that I've ever done, and trust me, they don't all get back to 20/20. And so I think recognizing the role of other factors that are beyond our control, luck, divine intervention, Daryl Bevel deciding not to run the ball on the one-yard line with Marshawn Lynch, all of those things, you know, have more of an impact on our outcomes in the sporting world or in the medicine world than maybe we often realize.
Are you going to make a prediction for Sunday? You don't have to if you don't want to.
I do have somewhat of a superstitious nature.
It's like Bill Simmons. You should do the reverse jinx and just pick the Falcons knowing that...
I'm not going to go that far. I think the Pats are favored by 3, and I like them to win and cover. So we'll see. By the time this airs, I'll either be... the prognosticator of prognosticators, or I'll look like an idiot. So,
the last thing
we'll see
about that, you know, I listened to Bill Simmons' podcast, and the Pats apparently, I think they've covered almost every game this year. Basically, every game that they haven't lost, they only lost 2 games all year, and I think they've covered every game that they've won. And I think that makes sense. I think if the Pats are going to win, they're going to win. Right, they're not a team that's gonna win by like 1 or 2 points. Not that they're not capable of it, but I don't know.
Their record against the spread has been incredible.
I think it's actually the best record against the spread ever. I think that they've never been a team that's only not covered against the spread twice in a full season, including, and that's in their only 2 losses. So I would say this: I think that if you're picking them to win, they're gonna cover. That's a pretty safe bet. I think picking them to win, but for the Falcons to win against the spread is probably a fool's bet. But what do I?
Yeah, it's too small.
Yeah. All right. Well, Matt.
We'll see. I'm excited. Thanks, Jay. Thanks for having me on. It's good to catch up.
No, it's great talking to you. And hopefully we can do something else in the future.
Love to.
More. Let you go. Enjoy the rest of your day on the West Coast. And enjoy the game on Sunday.
I will, man. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks again to Dr. Matthew Weed for joining us. As much as it pains me, our discussion of Tom Brady ended up being fairly prophetic, and congratulations to all the Patriots fans and our friends in Boston. Please continue to spread the word. As I mentioned, we are close to 3,000 subscribers. We were at just about 100 after Thanksgiving, so we are growing fairly quickly. Thanks to our producer, Louis Kai, for all of his hard work, as usual. We have some exciting episodes coming up, including one this Thursday on a highly reviewed article by Dr. Ashvini Reddy that has gone viral in the last couple of weeks. You won't want to miss that, so subscribe, and it will pop up in your phone or feed. This is Jay Sridhar signing off.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Good feeling.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth!